Hey, this is Matthew. Just wanted to jump into this recording to give you some context about what you're about to hear. This week's episode is actually part of a mini-series that I'm recording in partnership with Kaylee Jones Books about the craft of writing. So in this mini-series, each episode is going to be about a specific area of writing. Things like point of view, writing historical fiction, writing mystery, character development, plot structure, etc., etc. And we'll be interviewing a writer in the Kaylee Jones Books, Akashic Books stable. So each interview will be from a writer who has been published through that house. The conversations are going to take place for the most part over Zoom. So there will be a video version of these conversations, and that will be available on my YouTube channel. So just search up my name, Matthew McGevna, or the Ink Drop Podcast on a YouTube search, and you should find it there as soon as the podcast goes live on Spotify or Apple Podcasts. So I'm going to be kind of releasing them simultaneously. So if you're hearing this, but you'd rather watch the video, you can jump over to YouTube and you should see it there. First up on the docket is I spoke with Kaylee Jones, author and the founder of Kaylee Jones Books. She was also my professor at Southampton College's MFA program, and she published my first book, Little Beasts, in 2015. She came on to talk about something that I always admired her expertise on, which is point of view. And you'll get that sense as we talk about it in the video as the conversation continues. Point of view is, it's pretty tricky because there are rules, but there aren't rules. I actually went into the conversation thinking that there were more rules than there actually were. Kaylee does a nice job of kind of explaining how it works and how malleable it can be, and how some writers have kind of used different sort of almost parlor tricks to kind of pull off point of view in really interesting ways. So she talks a little bit about how it can function, how it delivers information to the audience while keeping information from some characters. Each point of view decision that you make as a writer carries its own limitations, but she also talks about some of the pitfalls and some of the early mistakes that writers will make regarding point of view in their first draft. Also, stick around towards the end of the conversation because I'm kind of introducing a sort of James Lipton-style rapid-fire question and answer to the interviews that I do. And if it goes well, I think I might try to do it anytime I talk to somebody on the show here. So you'll get some interesting bonus content about Kaylee that I thought was interesting as we get through the rapid-fire conversation, the rapid-fire portion of the conversation. Just a quick note on the audio. This conversation, as I said, was recorded on Zoom, so there are going to be some moments where Zoom cuts out a little bit, where her speaking or my question kind of gets chopped up a little. I thought about editing them out of the of it as I went through into post-production, but I thought that what she was saying was, you know, more important than just the audio quality, and the cutouts are kind of brief. They're not really long, dragged out, and annoying. They are annoying, but they're not as annoying. They're not long. It doesn't go on for 35, 40 seconds. So I thought, you know, just for the sanctity of the conversation, what she's saying was like a really interesting thing that she was saying. So I decided to leave it in there rather than really try to play around too much and clip out things and clip out some whole questions because, you know, we got about 5 seconds of audio drop or video drop. Just my apologies for that in advance. I just thought, you know, if you kind of like struggle through it a little bit, you'll be able to get more information than if I had cut it out to make it all one smooth conversation, you know, one smooth recording. So I hope you enjoy the conversation. Again, it's about point of view. And without any further ado, I give you Kaylee Jones on the craft of point of view.
Run me like a Hellcat.
Okay, I'm here for our craft series that we are launching in partnership with Kaylee Jones Books. And it's a series of
videos where we get into the actual nuts and bolts of writing. So it is a pleasure to conduct this interview with Kaylee Jones. She is the founder of Kaylee Jones Books and an author herself, and somewhat of a wizard on point of view, which is one of the first things we wanted to talk about in the early going, and one of the most difficult things to do. So we want to welcome Kaylee Jones. Hello, Kaylee.
Hi.
How are you? Kaylee, I know you've been, you know, I always consider you kind of an expert on point of view. When it comes to trying to figure out all the different complexities of it, I think a lot of people maybe take it for granted until they actually sit down to write, and then they realize how difficult it is. So I think one of the first questions that I would ask is what are the considerations that go into choosing a point of view when you sit down to write a story? What are some of the things you have to think about when you start to think about point of view?
The first thing I want to say is this concept may be revolutionary to a lot of people, but the least important thing in point of view is first person, third person, second person, omniscient, limited. All these things are irrelevant when you think about point of view as something that is completely flexible and malleable. So you can have a first person narrator who has sections of the book that are omniscient, right? Where that narrator is telling you things that happened that that narrator wasn't there for, right? So this is a question of establishing reliability, you know, like veracity. But people will start writing, and I think the first instinct is go with what feels right to you, like start, you know, she, blah, 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 or I, blah, blah, blah. But that's the least important thing. And we've always learned that in high school, and even in college, you know, what's the point of view in the story? Oh, it's third person. Third person omniscient, third person limited. But these things are all not truly relevant because it's a spectrum. Point of view is an absolute spectrum. And I don't think of it sort of on a line this way, but rather vertically, which is about, you know, the furthest away that you can be from the story you're telling. So that's more distance, right? And it can be physical distance or time distance. So the further away you are, the more generally speaking, the bigger the view, you could say. So from there to stream of consciousness, you have a very, very deep and gray, you know, area between the extremes. And thinking about point of view in terms of being in a box, like, okay, this narrator is going to be only this one character's perspective, is never actually really true, because there's always narrator that's above, beyond, and separate from the story that's being told, whether it's in first person or third person, right? Because if it's a first person narrator telling the story, right, there's going to be some amount of distance. I'm telling you about something that happened 4 years ago, 10 years ago, 20 years ago. That changes. However far away I am, that's going to change my voice of the story, how I tell the story. Same thing with third person. You know, are you going to start, if you're going to be shifting all over the place, you have to start with the notion that your narrative voice is going to be objective on some level and is going to be shifting in and out of different characters. It's really a question of flexibility. And I think people don't really understand that. It takes a long time to sort of let that sink in, and then study it in the books that you love and see it function in the books that you love.
And it's interesting that you mentioned about even with first person, that, because also one of the things readers can do is kind of ascertain the point of view of other characters, even though they may not necessarily be in their heads. Like, you can kind of get a sense of what other characters might be thinking through their actions, even if you're in the first person point of view. So it's interesting that you said, I never thought about
exactly.
It.
Exactly. Yeah. Right. And that's reflective in a sense, like depending on how well, if I'm a first person narrator, I'm telling you something like, my mother was really angry that day, right? That's a judgment. It's not descriptive. It's a judgment. If I've established that I know my mother very well, and therefore I can tell you that she was angry, that already establishes a certain amount of reliability. You know, I know what I'm talking about, but defining what anger is for that particular person is way more important than making a statement like, my mother was angry. But, and also, you can also do that in third person by somebody's behavior, facial expressions, tone of voice. You can determine certain things about how that person is feeling as they're, you know, but it's still considered external. So if you think about it as a spectrum, you would start with, you know, outside, right? Outside the character, way outside the character, then maybe a little bit outside and a little bit inside the character, which would be the next level. And then inside, completely inside the character, which was limited, or stream of consciousness, deeply inside the character. So you have a whole spectrum of choices. And there is no such thing as like static point of view. You know, just that one view for the whole thing would be unbelievably boring.
Right.
Right. And that's a big mistake you see a lot in neophyte fiction is this very stagnant, static view. I know this is already very complicated. This isn't beginner stuff at all, you know.
Yeah, yeah. It's interesting you say that because what are you, that leads right into my next question, which is what are some common mistakes that writers make when they change point of view? One of the things that you're a teacher as well as a writer, you've been teaching for many years, and I even had the benefit of going through a couple lessons on point of view in your class. Common mistakes that writers make when they change point of view or when they take on a particular point of view from the beginning. What are some of the more basic, if you broke it down to maybe a more introductory level, what do you see sometimes happening in some of your students' work, some of your undergrad?
I would say the number one mistake is in a third person narrative, right? Two people talking, people will shift like a camera, like a jump cut, you know, from one character's perspective into another, especially around dialogue. They'll just switch to the other person. And that's always a stumble for the reader because we need that transition. We need the eye of the story to shift off of one, out of the person, shift towards another person, and then enter that other person. You can't just cut and paste or cut and shift to somebody else without that transition. It never works. It never works. The other mistake I see very often is there'll be a flashback, right? Where somebody says, he remembered the day his father died, right? And in the middle of that flashback, which belongs to him, the one who's thinking about it, they'll shift to another character. But you can't shift to another person's point of view in a flashback because the flashback is already memory. It belongs to the person who's having the memory. So you can't shift outside of that person.
So you can't in a flashback. You can't have a third person. You can't have a third person point of view in the flashback because the flashback is in the character's mind.
Right. Right. Exactly. And that's a very, very common one. Sometimes also when you're even writing in the first person, often I see people, you know, trying to write strictly from that I view, right? I was 5 years old. And I did this and this, and they're trying to too much sound like a five-year-old. So they're condescending is the word. They're descending to the level of the child. And the problem there is that there's no language available for you. It sounds phony to start with. It sounds like you're imposing a childishness to the voice. It very rarely works. What works is to use epic language, enormous words, whatever words, and imitate the I view, like where you see the world, from when you're 5 years old, but not use the language of a 5 year old because that's so limiting. And children's emotions are epic, right? So epic language is necessary to show the enormity, you know, and I see that in first person very, my little hands, I stood there with my little hands, you know, but the thing is, no, when you're little, you don't think of your hands as little. So right there, you're having a problem of point of view, right? Right. Somebody else has a very big hand, you know, and your hand may seem little in that person's big hand. But so there's already like a point of view problem right there. Like who's seeing the little hand, me, the narrator now looking back, or is it the child? So there's a great spectrum even there in first person point of view.
Yeah, I made that mistake with Little Beast in one of the early edits. And I remember you caught it because I had my character, David. He was 15 years old and he was looking at the judge. And he said, you know, the judge was fairly young for a judge. He was in his 40s or 50s or he was fairly young. And you had written a note that was like, oh, yeah, because you said no 15-year-old thinks a 50-year-old person is young. They would never think about, you know. And but it
exactly. Might, that's a good example.
Right. So, yeah. Sometimes,
that's a good example.
Yeah, yeah. What options does a writer have? Let's say, okay, I get into my story, I'm writing it in first person, but then I realize there's like, I'm in New York City, but there's this thing that happened in Seattle and I need my reader to know that it happened. And now I want to like, now I'm like panicking because I want to be a little more omniscient. I want to take the camera and move it over to Seattle or into outer space. What are my options as a writer?
The easiest way to do that is to have it be a memory, right? So it's organic to the character, like something in the street reminds the character, you know, of something that happened in Seattle many years ago. And you set it up so that the memory is organic to the moment, right? Just absolutely organic. Don't cut like as the narrator and go, you know, three dots and then June 1973, right? Which then the readers, that's like a break in the narrative that's created by the writer.
Mm-hmm.
And it's not a flow. The whole point is to flow, trick the reader as much as possible to go with the flow. Like I remember reading the battle scene in, you know, the Battle of Austerlitz in War and Peace. And the beginning of the paragraph, you're with the Russian troops down in the valley, you know, in the fog. And by the end of the paragraph, you're in Napoleon's perspective on the top of the mountain above the fog. And I'm like, wait, what? How did he? Because it's so smooth that you don't even notice that that's what's happening. And that's the point, is you have to learn how to do it so that the eye of the reader can shift so naturally into a flashback. It's the same thing like, oh, here we are in New York, but something that happened in Seattle is very important to the scene. Then you have to somehow introduce that material. And the easiest way to introduce it is through the character's memory. And memory is triggered, right? Memories come to us. So you, finding the right place to put in, you know, a flashback that feels organic to the moment is the most important thing. And, you know, I remember reading a novel for the James Jones first novel contest, and it was really amazing. The first part was, you know, a treasure hunter is in the middle of the Amazon jungle and he falls through a hole in the ground and he's holding on, you know, with one hand, and it's a 50-foot drop and he's hanging there and he's gonna die. And then the chapter ends and the next chapter starts, you know, he was so happy back when he was 7 years old and he was, but everything about that is wrong because there's the emergency is dropped, right? The tone is completely counter to what you just left us with. So you can't break, right? And expect the reader to just stop that narrative right there and go into a completely different place and scene with a totally different tone when we're hanging with the character by, you know, by a vine inside this hole. You have to stay with that movement, that tone, you know, you can't just cut and move on to something else. It just, you break your narrative.
So is it, the question I would have is it always a good idea then to maybe, or would you recommend that people start with maybe third person omniscient? Because I would think it's easier just off the top of my head that it to go from like third person omniscient to a first person if I want to change my point of view. Like, is it better to have a narrator who has access to all information in the universe of the story and then be able to change it? Or but then that becomes like a recommendation you would make. Maybe that doesn't always work in all cases. What are your thoughts about that?
I think that's the wrong question, because I think no matter what, this is my opinion, no matter if it's called a limited third person or a limited first person, it's always omniscient because the writer is omniscient, right? The writer can see, if he or she chooses or they choose, into any character and to any part of the story they want. It's a choice. I choose to only tell you this story from this person's limited perspective, but that is not really the truth, because within that limited perspective, I still have to supply, it's my moral duty as the writer to supply what that character may not be aware of. And I have to do that somehow, right? I can't, otherwise you have a very, very small view. So there's always a puppeteer, even when you can't see the strings.
Yeah.
Does that?
Yeah, that's
very conceptual right now. But that, you know, that's really the point is, you know, even if you're thinking, okay, I'm going to start this, I would just say start, you know, start in first person, start in third person and see where it leads you. And, you know, if you feel the need to have another character's point of view, how do you shift the eye of the reader over to that new person? It's not that already established a kind of control of the narrative that has a wide view, a wide lens.
Now, speaking particularly with third person point of view, I think there was, if you were want the narrator to move around like the way Joyce kind of does in Ulysses and whatnot, have you updated your analogies or your imagery? Because I remember you made it clear back when I was a student of yours back in 1995, and you used the chalkboard, you went to the chalkboard and you used actually a card game, a poker game, as an example when writing in third person. And that I always loved it and it always stuck with me, this idea that you're like the eye above the card game, but you have to establish that first. Go ahead.
Joyce in Ulysses establishes his control over the narrative right away. The thing is, he goes into stream of consciousness almost immediately. So it sinks in deep, deep into a character's inner deepest, like almost direct thoughts, but it comes back out. It's not, you know, it's not an, it doesn't start in the middle of the stream of consciousness. It moves in and out. It's a very good example to look at Joyce, because I mean, I spent forever looking at the portrait of the artist as a young man to figure out, how did he do this? How did he make me feel like I'm this little boy lying in his bed or listening to this sermon where, but it's still third person. How did he do this? How did I feel like I was really in that character's deepest thoughts and emotions? And yet at times you're still outside that character. So that's that, you're walking a tightrope basically, right? The card game analogy is good because if you have a poker game with four people, right? And you want to shift to different people, you have to start up here and go, four men were sitting, or four people were sitting at a poker game playing poker, right? If I say Bob was sitting at a poker game with three other people and he held a pair of aces, I can't then go Joe, blah, 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 because you've now just completely broken the perspective you started with, right?
Right.
But it can be still manipulated back and forth in and out of different characters. You just have to shift the eye of the reader. Joyce, in fact, said the narrator is the God of the story, right? And so like God, he sits back indifferent, paring his nails. Like he really doesn't have, or at least he pretends not to have a real investment or a subjective judgment on who's right and who's wrong, right? Because if you're gonna give a lecture, Richard Price used to say this, if you're gonna send a message, go to Western Union. Like you can't stand on a soapbox and deliver opinions or polemics. It never works in fiction. Fiction's the exact opposite. You want to let the reader come to the conclusion, right? But you're still, as the writer and the narrator, you're still manipulating what we see.
Right. Yeah. And so if you're able to establish the card game as four men or four, you know, or four people sitting around the table, then you can go, Bob had a pair of aces. Jerry looked at Bob and wondered if he had a full house. You can bounce around.
Yes. Yes.
As long as you first start from that more of the omniscient level.
Right. Or bring us quickly out of, you know, if you start with Joe was sitting at the table holding a pair of aces, how do you get to the other guy across the table? Right. There are several ways to do it, right? But by describing the guy across the table, what he looks like, what he's doing, you know, you can slowly shift away from Joe, or it can be his opinion, right, of what the other guy looks like. So it's there is no set rule. That's what I'm trying to say, is like it's all malleable. It's all within your grasp to manage this. Point is, learning to do it is as hard, really, as learning, you know, to drive a car. When you first, I just taught my daughter last year to drive. And I remember sitting in the car with her, and she's sitting in the driver's seat looking like this at all these consoles and numbers and things and pedals and mirrors, and it's all new, right? So first you go, that's the gas, that's the thing, this is the wheel, these are the mirrors, right? First step. then you start to implement this on the road. And the more you do it, the easier it gets, to the point where we don't even think about it when we get in a car now. We really don't think about it. But at first, you have to understand what all these elements are before you can actually make them function.
Right, right. Yeah, that's a great analogy.
And I didn't learn this. I have to tell you, I went to Columbia for my MFA. I didn't learn this in my 2 years at Columbia. I learned this in the middle of writing my first novel, which I had a little tiny advance on. And I was working on this novel and I got stuck in the point of view. And I was like, why am I stuck? Why is this a problem? Why can I not get out of this care? Why does this feel so off? And finally, a friend said to me, because the narrator and the character are not the same person, are not the same. And it was like this, it was like a light bulb went off. It was huge. It was huge. And I still haven't found any articles except for one that actually addresses this sort of flexibility of point of view and how it functions, right? In every textbook, it's very simply presented as, you know, first person, second person, third person, you know, and it omniscient, you know, external, internal, but that does not give you the tool you need to understand how truly flexible point of view. I mean, in your novel, you did a fantastic job with an omniscient point of view of floating in and out of different characters because you understood this. You were able to set it up so that the whole community becomes the kind of spectrum through which we see the town, right? So that, you know, it's not an easy thing to learn, for sure.
No. Yeah. There was one particular case story I was working on where I remember where a teacher had driven onto a bridge and was contemplating suicide. And it was a third person. I can't quite remember the point of view, but I know in a workshop environment, like the question came up, like, how would anybody know that he stood out on this bridge? But I had a car full of kids drive by and honk at him. And just putting that detail in that kind of freed up the mind. Like it made it, and it took a little while for the group to read over it and be like, that's where that little trick of just putting kids on the bridge driving past him and honking at him was like, it was no longer just him. It was no longer a first person.
It broadened right away, the horizons, you know?
Yeah.
That's very interesting.
Yeah, it's
somebody looking at him this way rather than him looking inside himself or out from the bridge.
Yeah, and so it opened it up to the reader, so the reader was able to believe it. You know, I don't remember. My only thing is I don't remember whether I did it on accident or on purpose at the time, but it worked. You know, that was the question. You know?
Everybody can have an accident of genius, right? Or even maybe a couple of them. But the point is like knowing how to do it over and over again so that it feels smooth all the time and is not, a stumble when you try to shift back and forth in or out. Like, you know, even in memoir, like you have the narrator say, you know, years later, I realized blah, blah, blah. That's a shift in point of view. Too.
Yeah.
You know, it's more controlled, you know, it's more manipulative. You're telling the reader years later, I realized this wasn't what I thought it was right at the time. But you can also in memoir tell stories about your family, your grandparents that you did not witness, but we still believe you. And the reason we believe you is because you set it up that you're the receptacle, you're the speaker for the family. You know, you're the one through which the whole family's speaking, right? So you're the ancestral voice in a sense. But people start a memoir and they don't think they have that option. They think, no, it's a memoir. It's first person. I can't do that. I can't talk about what my ancestor thought when they came over, you know, from Italy or whatever, you know, but you can.
Yeah, yeah.
In fact, you must very often. Otherwise, the view is so limited.
Yeah. We aside from some of the technical challenges, and so what about some of the others, like leading into memoirs? You were talking about credibility, authenticity, even appropriation. We talked a little. One of the more interesting critiques that I read about American Dirt, when that became a bit of a scandal, when American Dirt came out, was The woman who first wrote the critique of American Dirt, Miriam Gerba, she noticed how the main character in American Dirt found herself shocked by some of the realities of Mexican life, right? She had written this thing like, which a Mexican would not be shocked by, right? So she had mentioned right. in her critique, a Mexican narrator wouldn't be shocked to learn that Mexico had an ice skating rink, right? As an example. These are like sensibilities, things that get absorbed into the culture of the, in the layers of a psyche of a character. Susan Tontag mentioned that it was something difficult to recreate also, to try to recreate somebody's point of view. So how do you, my question, I guess, is how do you safeguard against that? Is it something you need to have like an outside reader to catch that or?
This is another one of those, you're asking a very, very good question, which again, there's no yes and no good or bad box really here, except again, a spectrum, right? Where what I find, and this terribly unfortunate, people who are writing about a different culture very often assume certain things, and that's because of their limited knowledge of that culture, right? So they will assume certain things and not do the research necessary to really explore that culture. We have so many options in terms of really trying to understand what it's like to grow up a Native American woman, for example, right? Or something like that. But, you know, first of all, I think let's let the Native American women write about being Native American women. First of all, that I really feel strongly about. But there are cases where, like Deirdre Sinnott, who's one of her book just recently came out with Kaylee Jones' books, this was a big issue. Deirdre was an activist for 35, 40 years where she literally was arrested, you know, for marching for what she believed was injustice in this, against injustice in this country. When she wrote her book about 1835 Utica, New York, and the impact of slavery in the North, even when slavery was not at that time, it had just been made illegal actually in the North, you know, the complicity and so on. She had an escaped enslaved person, you know, there who'd escaped and was hiding there in Utica. She was so tortured by the thought that she might be not representing this character properly, that she did get a few, she didn't pay them, but she had enough friends who read it very carefully for her to tell her whether or not it felt genuine and the voice was correct, you know, for that time. This is a big, I mean, I've seen this over and over again too. And for me, the problem is always a lack of knowledge, like assumptions that are made. Like I had a book not too long ago where, you know, the character was half, Seminole Indian or American Indian, and you know, the rituals were so stereotypical, not even specific to Seminole, you know. And to me, that's where we get into real trouble, is when we just go with the tropes, you know, go with what we saw in a Disney movie, you know, rather than really doing the work. And sometimes that means going there, you know, going to that place and really spending some time there and learning about what these people feel and think. But this isn't easy. I mean, I spent an entire AWP, you know, the Association of Writing Professors, one of those, you know, 4-day symposia, going to hear people speak, you know, hearing people of color speak about how they felt about cultural appropriation. And across the board, they said what I'm saying now, which is research, people. It's not that we're saying you can't write about something, but you really need to know your subject. And if you don't know your subject, you know, you're going to rely on shallow stereotypes and tropes. You know, I also feel that it's wrong to, and this is, if I'm going to tell, you know, if I'm going to tell somebody that they need to, like, I can say, don't you dare post anything like that on my Facebook page, because I won't put up with it. That's my page and I can say whatever I want, you know. But at the same time, like, I think that the left can get overly sensitive at times, and then everybody jumps on the bandwagon, and now this new thing is like cultural appropriation. Everybody's terrified of having any character in a story that's not from your own race, religion, sex, and I think that's going too far the other way too. That is not good either. Anything that really completely causes censorship is not a good thing, right. You know. So they're, you know, both ends of the spectrum are very complex, I think.
Yeah. Yeah, there's an in-between there somewhere. Yeah. Are you ready for some rapid-fire questions?
Yes.
All right.
I hope so.
So just going to ask some, these are questions that we'll just kind of ask as we go through the series at the end, just to wrap it up. But thanks for this conversation about Point of View. This is really helpful. Hopefully some writers, particularly new writers, got something out of it in terms of where to start. Get some of these questions answered. For rapid fire, I would say, what is the best piece of writing advice you ever got?
Larry Heineman said to me once, if you're going to run a marathon with it, you have to really care about it. So it has to be something that makes you angry enough or sad enough or passionate enough to go the distance with it.
What's the worst piece of writing advice you ever got?
Give yourself a word number at limit every day and meet that word limit no matter what. That was terrible advice. Terrible.
What genre do you have no interest in writing?
No interest in writing or no interest in reading? No interest in writing. Romance. Oh.
Biggest killer of your writing time?
Reading. Teaching. What? Teaching. You know, and reading my students' work and reading books to, that I'm teaching. Yeah.
What is one item on your bucket list?
For writing, you mean, or for?
In general.
Life.
Yeah, in life.
I want to write a dystopian novel. I really do. And I've been working on it, but it's really not a new genre for me reading, but a new genre for me in terms of writing. And I have a really good idea, but I'm still trying to figure out how to, work it out.
And last, what's the one thing about the publishing world we're not talking about, but should be?
Consensus. There's too much consensus, we all have to agree that this book is a good book for us to buy. And the minute you have consensus like that, and when it's all about money and not about art, we're getting close to being in trouble.
Kaylee Jones, thank you so much. I appreciate it.
Thank you, Matt.
Hellcat.